Hello and welcome to another episode of Admit One with me, Antonia O'Brien, where each week I challenge a special guest with the task of picking their top three favourite films.
I sat there just kind of completely floored by how brilliant I thought this film was.
Joining me on this episode is Head of Festivals at the BFI, Claire Stewart.
And so you get this sense of tension between this liberating space and this wound up angry man who doesn't know what to do with his emotions.
Claire, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here.
Very interesting on your Twitter, seeing, you know, for someone who works in film, that you grew up in a small town without a cinema and have been madly overcompensating ever since. So how did you first get into film?
Well, I first sort of discovered the passion, I guess, when I moved to Melbourne to start university. And I was studying cinema studies as one of my subjects. I mean, before that, you could count the number of films I'd seen on the big screen on two hands. There was like Lee and Gaffer Drive-In and Wonthaggi Cinema. Mm-hmm. And they were both half an hour's, you know, kind of drive away from where I lived. Although I did have the really sort of intriguing experience as a child of growing up in a town where there was a recreated historical village. And so a lot of films and television shows were shot there. So I was an extra as a child in quite a number of those productions. So in a sense, I sort of had the appetite for the behind-the-scenes elements before I fully understood that I had this, you know, great passion for actually watching films and now, obviously, taking that further to connecting audiences with films.
I know exactly what you mean when you say a recreated kind of old-fashioned village, because I'm half Australian and I went to Old Sydney and they kind of dressed me up and I had a picture and you look kind of like you're from the 1890s.
That's where I worked as a teenager, like, you know, corset, period costume, the whole bit, serving Devonshire teas in 40 degree heat. It gave me a strong sense of drama.
I'd like to know how you went from being extra in 1890s Australia to becoming the director of London Film Festival.
Well, I started after I kind of graduated. I guess I had that thing of like, I've learnt some elements about film production. I've learnt some elements about film theory. I can't make those two things together. I just have to watch more films. So I sort of threw myself into everything I could, including the local Cinematheque, the Melbourne Cinematheque, and very quickly started working with the programming team there, volunteering at the Australian Film Institute. I also volunteered for the local film radio show and just started to kind of soak up a whole lot of different aspects of the industry and, I guess, the sort of critical arena and critical thinking around film. Out of that, I sort of ended up working at the Australian Film Institute, first in their research department back in the days before we even had IMDb at our fingertips. I remember those days. It's hard to imagine how I got by without it.
Life before Instagram? What?
So working there and then went on to be sort of running the National Cinematheque Circuit in Australia out of the Australian Film Institute. Went from there to head up the cinema department at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image in Melbourne, which was this very exciting new building that opened in 2002 or three. Gosh, my memory's getting foggy. And had an amazing time there because that was really a centre that was ahead of its time. It had a huge gallery and cinemas, a games lab. It was really the first institution in the world to kind of commit itself to thinking about the idea that everything screen-based was going to become what it is now, which is practically ruling everybody's lives, let's face it. So it was the first kind of institution dedicated to thinking about things on the screen in all of its forms. And it was an amazing time. I went from there to direct the Sydney Film Festival for 5 years and from there to my current role at the BFI, where I head up the festivals department and direct the BFI London Film Festival in October and also oversee BFI Flare, the LGBT Film Festival, in March.
gosh, doesn't sound like you've got much on.
Well, some of that is no longer on, obviously. Yeah.
I'd love to know, to people listening to Admit One, who would like to work in the film industry in the capacity that you do, what would your advice be?
In the programming space, which is the space that I work in, there's now courses. I mean, the NFTS has just introduced a course last year on programming. But for many, many years, that's not been the case. It's definitely a space where you sort of have to get in on the ground and, you know, work your way up, really. And one of the great places to do that, of course, is at festivals. I mean, we have an enormous number of highly valued volunteers that work with us every year at the festival. They get a bit of a taste for what it takes to deliver the festival behind the scenes. They kind of get a sense, you know, am I more interested in production? Am I more interested in guest hospitality? Am I more interested in the programming side of things? And, you know, that is a very good way to kind of, I guess, get a bit of a foot in the door, as it were. But there are lots of really great initiatives. I mean, I think the UK is incredibly privileged. The BFI is an extraordinary organisation. There's nowhere like it in the world. They're really literally isn't an organisation that does everything from archiving film to, you know, investing in the development of new filmmakers to production to exhibition and distribution initiatives. It's, you know, a very well-supported sector in the UK. And of course, that expands out much further than just the organisation that I work for.
That was going to be my next question, which you sort of touched on, is how does the BFI nurture the young and up-and-coming talent? Because that's so important, you know, for the festivals that you run, to make sure you do have great British talent.
Well, discovery is a great role of all festivals, you know, a very significant aspect of what we do. At the London Film Festival, we're very committed to directors and filmmakers across the board. You know, we have a very substantial short film programme, which is obviously where a lot of people get started in terms of actual filmmaking. We have a first feature competition that really shines a light on people who've just made their debut. And often those films are, you know, very low budget, very independent, and we are celebrating them, giving them a platform that kind of scales them up, introduces them to wider audiences, hopefully. We also have a range of schemes, of mentorship schemes. We are running a scheme now for the third year with BFI Flair that's about developing new LGBTQ filmmakers in the UK. And that's a fantastic scheme where we actually match five, I think you can be a writer, producer or director, with an established industry figure.
Kind of like a mentorship.
Correct. And that program goes on for a sort of 8-month period, and they really get, you know, a great sort of connection into the industry, and they get someone who actually is invested in their future, which is a very important, you know, part of it.
Claire Stewart, would you say it's one of your most frustrating questions when someone asks you to pick your three favourites?
Well, it's not frustrating as much as it's kind of vaguely terrifying, because, you know, my life, the life I live, is about my love of cinema in every sense of the word. I live and breathe it every day. And so for me, the idea that there's a hierarchy is kind of almost kind of illegal, or
maybe we do a special and it's Claire Stewart of the BFI's top 100 films.
Even that would be challenging.
Yeah. Oh, I can't
pick
them.
I mean, but it's always really interesting to me, the sort of, you know, the kind of obsession that we have in our culture with list making. And often the top 10 lists of all time in film, you know, the BFI's wonderful publication Sight and Sound does a decade poll. Every decade they poll filmmakers and critics about what are the best 100 films of all time. And it's pretty stunning to me that the last poll, which I think was 2012, you know, Psycho knocked Citizen Kane off its perch, which it's been on for decades. And you look at that top 10 and I'm going, But hang on, there are no films in that top 10 that were made after I was born. So everybody thinks about, oh, my favourite films, my best films. They think into the history of cinema. Mm-hmm. It's much harder, I think, for people to go...
Favourite.
These are favourite, these are best, but they're actually close to, you know, my own viewing experience, my own life, the time that I've lived through. And so I decided to sort of... today to choose three films that were films that were made contemporaneous to me that meant something very important to me when I saw them.
So the first of your three that you've chosen for today, your three favourites today, Claire Stewart, which is the first?
Well, the first one is the second feature film directed by Wong Kar-wai, who, of course, is probably most well known for his wonderful film In the Mood for Love with Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung. This film is his second feature. It's called Days of Being Wild. It was made in 1990. Some records say 91. Let's not worry too much about that. But for me, it was a sort of startling discovery, going back to that importance of discovery. At that time, I was still at uni. I was throwing myself into the culture of film festivals. I'd really only just discovered, in a sense, world cinema, the idea that there was cinema outside of Hollywood. And that, to me, was a, you know, very critical, very exciting, very expansive moment. So I was during the Melbourne Film Festival, and I'd already seen like five or six films that day. And one of my friends said, oh, but I hear there's this really amazing film on at the Chinatown Cinema. These are the days where there were still Chinatown, you know, cinemas. They're not, though, they don't have them anymore. And they had this midnight screening of this film by this new director, Wong Kar-wai, no one had ever heard of. But it was getting a bit of critical buzz. And so we decided, doesn't matter that we've already just, you know, seen five or six films at the festival, let's go down to the midnight screening at Chinatown. And I was just, you know, completely blown away by this film. The visual language, it was the first film that Wong Kar-wai shot with the cinematographer Christopher Doyle, who he would subsequently work with many times. It was beautifully lush, it was romantic, it was melancholic, had one of the great dance scenes in cinema, Leslie Cheung kind of doing a little mambo number in his boxer shorts in the hotel room. And just kind of, I guess, captivated my imagination. And also was the start of, you know, a really passionate interest in this filmmaker, who would go on to make films like Chungking Express and Happy Together and In the Mood for Love and Ashes of Time, all of which, you know, if you made me do that top 100, would be in that top 100. So a defining filmmaker, you know, for me. And and Leslie Cheung, you know, Kanto pop star who very tragically committed suicide, one of the great kind of faces in cinema. He embodies for me something that is a bit like the great French director Bresson talks about, you know, dismissing actors and going for models in cinema, this idea that you're not actually looking for an articulated performance, but you're looking for the passive surface of face and a body that will allow you, the audience, to, you know, ascribe feelings or emotions or thoughts onto it. And that is the kind of performer that Leslie Cheung is in this film. He's also incredibly sexy and, you know, very adored by his gay admirers as well as his female admirers.
Well, the dancing in the pants sounds, you know, very... I mean, I'm yet to see the film, but, I mean, that was my most highbrow, brilliant question for that film. I wanted to ask you, with Wong Kar-wai's films, his archive of films, what's his distinctive kind of directorial style? If you didn't know they were by him, would you know that they are his work?
I think so. I mean, I think he's got an incredibly precise visual style that he's evolved with both cinematographer Christopher Doyle and his production designer William Chang, that is very sort of steeped in colour, in place, in movement. So movement feels like it's no accident that there are dance sequences in his films, because movement is, you know, very much a part of his MO in terms of the way narratives work as well. But he also returns quite consistently to themes about romantic longing, about loving the wrong person, about someone loves someone, but that someone loves someone else. You know, these are unrequited love. These are themes that he is consistently returning to.
I'm so interested to watch Days of Being Wild and more of his work. I'm not familiar. This is going to be a wonderful education for me. And your second choice, Claire?
My second choice is, weirdly, I've kind of gone almost decade by decade. It's jumping from 1990 to 1999. And it's a film called Beau Travail by Claire Denis, who is a French director who I admire enormously. I think her and Catherine Bigelow are two women directors who I think handle male crisis and male beauty with such rigour and elegance that is actually rarely matched by directors of the other gender. So this is a different kind of scenario for me to Wong Kar-wai, which was very much about a moment of discovery. Claire Denis, I'd been tracking for many years. I'd seen a number of her films already. You know, had been very much a fan of films like Nanette Ebony and I Can't Sleep. She had a very evocative way of working both with actors and with narrative. So clearly this is something that appeals to me, because that's quite consistent with the interest in Wong Kar-wai. Music is also very essential to her films, and I love the stuff that she had done with the Tindersticks, who have scored a number of her films, or whose music she's used often as well.
Wow, that sounds incredible. Can you give me an overview of the film?
This film is set in the French colony of Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. It follows a character played by Denis Levant, who some people listening might know from his role in Holy Motors a couple of years ago. And he plays an officer of the French Foreign Legion who is second in command. He's kind of in awe of his commander, played by Michelle Subur. And everything becomes a bit unsettled for him when this young recruit, played by Gregoire Collin, arrives. This guy has a very sort of laid-back style. He's very at ease with life. And this very tense, kind of wound up, held back, you know, quite repressed Denis Levant character is completely, you know, jealous of him, obsessed with him, and things happen, which I'm not going to say because people should just go out and watch the film. There are many things I love about it. One of the particularly is, again, the collaboration with the cinematographer here. The cinematographer is Agnès Godard, who Claire Denis had already worked with a couple of times. And there's this extraordinary sense of space. The landscapes are beautiful and very, very open and kind of quite wild. And so you can't really... And so you get this sense of tension between this liberating space and this wound up angry man who doesn't know what to do with his emotions. So that space becomes, you know, increasingly oppressive. And that's really beautifully done. Also has a great dance scene. I'm big on my dance scenes.
That could be another top 100 we do.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, I'm sort of leaving out Written on the Wind, Douglas Sirk's film, which is really, truly one of my favourite films. And the Dorothy Malone dance sequence in that is, you know, killer, but I digress. Mm-hmm. So this film, you know, ends with a kind of a scene that is this angry upset, weird kind of soldier making his bed very meticulously. And then it cuts to him just going absolutely apeshit on the dance floor to Rhythm of the Night.
So, Claire, dance seems like a recurring theme. Do you also love musicals?
I am a big fan of musicals. Yes, I am.
Now, I mean, it's only February, so saying one of the films of the year is a big shout. But, I mean, La La Land has been a huge trumpeting triumph. Have you seen it?
Well, yes, we had the UK premiere at the London Film Festival. When we showed it, it only screened at that point in Venice and Toronto, and we were, I think, the third festival to show it. You know, the sense of expectation that the audience had of the film was kind of palpable in the room. And in our matinee screening of it, Ryan Gosling made a surprise appearance at the Q&A because we hadn't been able to get him for the evening screening because he was on set for Blade Runner, but we managed to get him out of Hungary, I think they were shooting in. So, you know, a career highlight for me was insisting on...
Can you see my wide eyes? Well, I'm like, no, tell me more.
Well, I convinced the producers and Damien and Ryan that we all had to dance out on stage at the end of the credit sequence. And we did. So I've had my little dance moment with, you know, with Ryan.
Oh, my gosh. Talk of career highlights, having a dance with a leading man. Ryan Gosling from La La Land. I mean, that's got to go straight to the top.
Oh, it's pretty up there.
Mm. So, Claire, your third and final favourite film. I feel like I want to keep saying of today because, like you said, it's very hard to pick your favourite films.
Definitely. Well, next, and here or there, I can, you know, I can say with a very clear sense of conscience, there are no dance scenes in the in the next film, although the camera often dances in its own way, and certainly the narrative does. It's a film called A Separation. It was made in 2011. It's directed by Asghar Farhadi, whose film The Salesman is nominated for a foreign language Oscar this year, and who, of course, is the centre of quite a lot of attention at the moment, given Trump's ban on seven countries. Anyway, he's from Iran. He can't attend the Oscar ceremony because of where he's from. This film is a wonderful kind of moral tale. It sort of anchors, I guess, in an ethical dilemma. We meet a husband and wife who are at a court asking for a divorce. They're not really out of love, but they can't reconcile this issue, which is she wants to leave Iran with their 11-year-old daughter so that her daughter can grow up in a better place, a place that will have more freedoms and better access for her to education and less gender issues and so forth. He doesn't believe her or doesn't share the same views about Iran. And also he has an ailing father with Alzheimer's who he doesn't want to leave. So their divorce is not necessarily happening because they have these, you know, much bigger irreconcilable differences. It's happening around this one issue. But the film opens with both of them addressing the camera like, we, the audience, are the jury for this film, you know. And in terms of what subsequently happens, you know, the split triggers a whole sort of snowballing set of events. Each one happens because someone has made a choice, a bad choice usually, rather than a good choice, and everything kind of becomes very unravelled. I'm talking quite deliberately around the plot.
So you kind of go on a journey through their relationship to understand the very beginning, you're in the courts, and then you're kind of going back in time with them.
Well, you're not actually going back in time, you're going forward in time with them. So you are, what happens subsequent to the court case is that they go home, she decides she's moving out, she's going to go and live with her mother. He has to find somebody to look after the house because that's, of course, what she's been doing. And the woman who comes to look after the house, an incident happens, which triggers a whole kind of avalanche of effects. So it's really about the sort of differences between class, differences between gender, differences between the sort of institutional culture, the religious culture. And it's a very, very clever film because it never once critiques that any one of those elements, you know, it just reveals many things by the way that it sets up its drama.
You don't feel that it's biased to either side.
Correct.
It's kind of just telling the story.
Although the women can definitely see what's going to happen, whereas the men can't. That's the only bias, I'd say. But, you know, to me, this is super interesting, having a filmmaker who can actually make a film that says many, many things about the politics of his country without explicitly stating them, which means it's not banned in his country, where actually many of the great Iranian filmmakers, of course, Panahi, who's now not supposed to be making any films, Kiarostami, while he was still alive, his films were often winning awards overseas but not necessarily being shown at home. So, you know, this is also a film that not only went on to actually win the foreign language Oscar that year, but it was also seen by many, many people in Iran as well as many, many people around the world. I mean, for me, the personal connection was seeing the film in an early morning screening at the Berlinale where it premiered. So I was in an 8:30 screening and I sat there just kind of completely floored by how brilliant I thought this film was. And I found it very upsetting. I had a lot of Iranian filmmaker friends. I'd been there. I knew a lot about the culture. So it's by no means a weepy, but I was weeping at the end of it, you know. So I let everybody else leave the cinema, all 2,000 other people that were in the cinema, and I sat there, you know, until I gathered my thoughts. And then I had to race immediately to the sales agent and negotiate it. This is when I was directing Sydney Film Festival, and negotiate it into the Sydney Film Festival. So I had to do that thing, which my job entails quite a lot, where I switch off my emotions in order to go into negotiating mode. But anyway, I was very glad I did because it won the best film at the Sydney Film Festival that year.
I was about to say, how was it received at the Sydney Film Festival? Mm. Very well.
Very well indeed.
Watching films being such a huge, huge key part of your job, do you also enjoy watching films when you're just chilling out in you know, downtime?
Well, one of my great pleasures post-festival is to just go to the cinema as a punter, you know, buy my ticket, get my popcorn. I mean, I watch probably between 600, 700 films a year, and popcorn I probably only get to eat 3 times, you know. So just buying into being the audience is something that I genuinely love. So, I do it in my spare time too.
The final part of each Admit One podcast is where I do spring a surprise question on my guest, which is, if you had to choose an actor to play you in the story of your life, who would you choose and why?
I'm tempted to say Robert Mitchum. I'd love Robert Mitchum to play me, actually. I mean, obviously he's dead, so he couldn't. I love...
Past or present, male or female?
Yeah, well, I mean, I loved it when Cate Blanchett played Bob Dylan in, Todd Haynes' wonderful film. So I'm going to go with Robert Mitchum. And the reason why is because I think he's got this very laconic, laid-back approach, but he's got this kind of bubbling intensity under the surface. And actually, I'm probably the complete opposite of that. I think I'm like bubbling intensity on the surface and I've got a little bit of laconic underneath. But let's go with Bob.
It was your knee-jerk choice. I must say, you were the first person to choose a male actor to play you in your life story.
Well, you know, it seems appropriate to do a little bit of gender shiftings, shall we say, when we are, you know, just days away from BFI Flare, the London LGBT Film Festival. So I love a bit of gender ambiguity.
Claire Stewart, thank you so much for your time today. That has been Honestly, a delight, a film and cinematic education for me, and I now have lots of world cinema on my list.
Obviously, if anyone's interested in the festival, go check out bfi.org.uk/flare. That's FLARE. So flare as in a beacon of light. And you can get tickets for the LGBT Fest there.
And as always, if you enjoyed the show, spread the word, give us a review on iTunes and share the love on Twitter using the AdmitOne hashtag and tweeting me at Antonia O'Brien. That's it for this episode. Next week on Admit One.
See, these are movies that I believe that anybody could watch without having to look at. Anybody at all. And you'd understand it perfectly.
The blind film critic, Tommy Edison.
I always say, if you have all this fancy stuff on screen, all this eye candy, as I like to call it, then you don't need much of a story, because who cares? You got all these neat effects that are going to keep the audience enraptured, so it's all good.
Don't forget to subscribe to Admit One on iTunes for more movie memories from my stellar lineup of guests.
Admit One with Antonia O'Brien is an Audioboom production.